This talk will discuss the pure time preference theory of interest and make some comments about the critics of this theory and their views. We've covered a lot of ground this week. Just to quickly review, we've talked about the physical laws of the relationship between means. So you've discussed the structure of production, or the capital structure, as we call it. We've also talked about the laws of valuations of means and ends. We discussed the laws of utility and what these mean for the pricing of goods, and then the imputation of value, and how we value factors of production relative to the value of the consumer goods that we use in action. We've also talked about the economic laws of appraisement of means and ends, pricing of goods, and the pricing of the factors of production, and how the entrepreneur anticipates the monetary value of things and then arranges production accordingly. And what we want to do in our time in this lecture is talk about, first of all, the laws of the valuation of time. And we'll see that there are two basic ways in which we value our action with respect to time. The first way is in the timing of our action. So in some circumstances, the value of our action will be different depending upon the moment in time when we take the action. So that's one thing that we want to address. And then the other area of valuation of our action with respect to time is what we call in economics time preference. And time preference doesn't have to do with the timing of an action, how we prioritize our actions and set them in a sequence in time. It has to do with intertemporal valuation, how we value our actions with respect to gaining a satisfaction in the present relative to gaining the same satisfaction in the future. So it's an intertemporal exchange or trade-off that we're thinking about. And then after we talk about the valuation of these things, we'll also talk about appraisement, that is pricing with respect to these two elements. And perhaps you can see already we'll have, therefore, two different types of prices to discuss. The first type that corresponds to the timing of our action and the timing, the value of means with respect to the timing in which we take an action, we will call temporal prices. And temporal prices will come to exist in the market in forward transactions or in futures markets. And then the intertemporal valuations that we do lead to prices in markets that we call interest rates. So the interest rate is based upon time preference, our intertemporal valuation. And then we have a different kind of set of prices in markets that we'll call temporal. They're not intertemporal, but just the time at which we choose to take an action. Next week, a month from now, a year from now, and so on. Okay, so let's start with the easy part first, and because this isn't the main topic of our talk, of course, is time preference. So let's start with the temporal aspect of this first, and we'll get this out of the way. It's important to delineate this because a lot of commentators confuse the two. They conflate the two. Their theory of interest is like a combination of timing and time preference, and if you do this, it leads to endless confusion. So we want to make sure we're keeping these distinct. Okay, as Mises liked to say, when we think about time in action, we notice right away that time is, as Mises would say, an irreversible flux. One of his great phrases, right? Time is an irreversible flux. So it's just passing by moment. And because of this, it's quite apparent on some reflection that we cannot treat times analytically as a means in action. Time isn't like labor or capital funding or land or a physical capital good that we can accumulate and hold on to and then decide to use you know, en masse at some particular point. Like I save up a bunch of money and then I buy a new car with it. No, time just passes by for all of us. It's just continuing to pass by. And time is, in this sense, irreversible, right? It passes by from the present moment into the next moment and so on and so forth. So when we think about how we might value our action with respect to time, we see, again, that we can't treat it in the standard way that we would treat a means. But we can place our action in the temporal sequence. So it is possible for us to choose the moment in time when we take an action. And in many instances, the moment in time that we take an action can affect its value. For some actions, this isn't the case, and therefore we wouldn't choose with respect to a different value that might accrue to us if we take an action today or next week or the week after. Just to give you a mundane example, my wife's birthday is August 18th. So the value of taking the action of throwing a surprise birthday party for her, won't be a surprise if she watches Mises.org, is greater on the day of her birthday, on August 18th, as opposed to, say, taking it on September 1st or August 4th. Right? And many actions are like this. And this explains why we prioritize our actions, why we choose the timing of our action. We choose to take an action at that point in time that, you know, ceteris paribus, that would give us the greatest value. And this, again, we call the temporal aspect of action. Now, as I mentioned, if there are means that we're using in this process, then we would also have a differential value of the means that we use in the action at different points in time. So to change my example slightly, it might be that world market supply and demand for oil, let's say, is different today than it will be 6 months from today. And individuals who trade oil might recognize this. They might, let's say, anticipate that the U.S. under Obama will attack Iran, and Iran's oil production will go offline, and the stock of oil will become more scarce in the future, and so the price in the future compared to today will be higher. And if they're able to engage in trade on the basis of these anticipations, then we can get forward prices. We can get prices that emerge that reflect the fact that the timing at which we intend to use a means might have different value at one moment in time versus another moment in time. And you probably heard already during the week that, let's say, if the present spot price of oil is $100 a barrel, and let's suppose that 6 months futures price of oil is $200 a barrel, that the reason why this is part of the economizing aspect of the market economy is because, just like any other price differential, this will create profitable arbitrage opportunities. So we can move a barrel of oil from where its value is lower to where its value is higher, just like we could do this geographically if the price of oil were $200 a barrel in Japan and $100 in the U.S., then it would be economizing to move oil from the U.S. to Japan. But as the speculators arbitrage across this price difference, they'll bring the prices together, right? So the same thing will happen intertemporally through speculation. So there'll be, there'll be the holding on of oil today, and then the for a sale in the future, and then the disgorging of the oil in the future when the if the higher price came about. This will drive the price up today, and if people are making forward transactions, it will drive that forward price down today until they come into some kind of economizing relationship. So this is how we see forward prices emerging and how futures markets operate and why they're part of the economizing feature of the market economy. Okay, so that's all we'll say about that, and we'll turn our attention to the main show here, which is about time preference and the rate of interest. Okay, so here again we take Mises as our guide, and Mises points out that any temporal being, any existing human person that exists in time recognizes immediately the difference between sooner and later. This is just part of what it means to be temporal, that this is an important distinction for us, the difference between sooner and later. Now, once we recognize this distinction, it's possible for us to value with respect to this distinction, just like we recognize that there are means in the world, and so we can value them and as aids to the attainment of our end or other aspects of action. We recognize that sooner and later might make a difference to us with respect to the value of attaining our ends. And so Mises says this, it is just in the nature of temporal existence that a given satisfaction is always preferred sooner as opposed to the same satisfaction attained later. That once we recognize this difference between sooner and later, we also immediately recognize that having a given end satisfied is preferable if it can be satisfied sooner as opposed to later. By the way, this principle is the counterpart to the principle we call the second law of utility on the lecture Monday, which says that more of a good is preferred to less. Why is that? Why do we recognize right away that more of a good is preferred to less? Well, it's because we're finite beings for whom all of our ends are not satisfied, and therefore having more means available to us implies that we can attain more of our ends, and we prefer to attain more of our ends as opposed to fewer. So this is a similar kind of basic fundamental feature of human existence. Because we're temporal, we recognize the difference between sooner and later. We also see just immediately that the sooner satisfaction of an end is preferred to the same satisfaction to be attained later. Now, just to emphasize this point, this is a logical claim that Mises makes. It's a praxeological claim that Mises makes, and it's not then to be confused with psychological claims. It has nothing to do with people's psychological state of mind. It doesn't refer to the fact that people might be impatient and not like to wait. You know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but that has nothing to do with time preference. It's not referring to that. It's also not referring to physiological aspects of human life, that we have urgent physiological needs that have to be met every day. We have to eat and hydrate our bodies and so on and so forth. This is all true, but it doesn't have anything to do with time preference. Time preference is referring to a different aspect of human action from these psychological or physiological dimensions. Mises is also quick to point out that because this is an overarching view, because it's a basic fundamental principle involved in all action, time preference must exist in all circumstances of acting. It doesn't matter if a person is rich or poor or in society or out of society. You know, none of that matters, whether they're, you know, whether they have money in exchange or they don't have money. It must be the case that in all conditions of acting, a person has time preference. A person always prefers a sooner satisfaction of an end to a later satisfaction of the same end. Now, given that we've established the principle of time preference, there's several implications, immediate implications of it. And so let's run through a few of these. Again, they're helpful in just creating a more robust notion in our mind of what we're really talking about when we speak of time preference. Okay, one implication would be this. If we're going to engage in a longer process of production, a process of production that extends out the production process and delays the attainment of our end to a later period as opposed to a sooner, it must be the case that this longer process of production generates a future good that's more valuable than the goods we're giving up in the process of extending production in time. Right? We would never intentionally engage in a production process that took us longer just to get goods that have the same value as the goods we're giving up by abandoning a shorter production process. Right? So that must always be true. These goods, of course, that we obtain in the future that have greater value to us in some production processes that are lengthened might be the same good. So we could imagine, for example, people farming and they're using primitive tools and just using scythes and, you know, hand tools, and they're reaping wheat or whatever it might be, we can imagine them starting then in longer processes of production to produce a more capital-intensive production process, just so they increase the physical productivity of land and labor in the production of wheat. So they eventually produce combines and heavy equipment like they use in Nebraska, corn huskers, right, in eastern Nebraska, at least when there's some rain that comes, to increase their productivity of the same good in the future to greater heights than they could with shorter production processes. Many times, though, we engage in longer production processes to produce future goods that are of a completely different type that we can't produce with short production processes. So this is a Boom Bovaric's notion of the roundabout production process, right? So we go through all these steps, through the stages of production. We mine iron out of the ground. We produce steel. And we fabricate fenders. And eventually we make an automobile, which is a process of production we could not engage in with primitive tools. We can only have longer, drawn-out production processes to create those sorts of goods. Okay, now another implication is that at any given moment in time, it must also be the case, because of time preference, that the shortest, most productive production processes have already been adopted by people. Whatever they can produce most readily in the shortest periods of time, they will have already adopted these production processes and exploited them. This is why when we talk about business cycle theory in the Austrian view, we say that when the central bank engages in monetary inflation through credit expansion in the banking system, that it sets in motion this extra credit and process, sets in motion a lengthening of the structure of production. Why is that? It's because all of the shortest, most direct, most productive production processes have already been undertaken. The only thing that's left to us are longer, more drawn-out processes of production. So this is true generally speaking. We can also think of what would be logically implied if there weren't time preference. What if we presuppose that people had no preference between a sooner satisfaction and the same satisfaction in the future? Then it would be the case, of course, that the principle of more is preferred to less would dominate all of our action. And so, for example, we would never engage in short production processes if there were a longer production process that would give us a more valuable future good. We would always indefinitely extend the production processes if we didn't care whether or not we got the satisfaction today relative to some later period. We would indefinitely extend it, for hundreds of years, presumably, or at least for the end of our lifespans. But, of course, we don't do this, right? We engage in production processes that are the most direct, the shortest, most productive production processes that we can imagine. Now let me turn to some alleged exceptions to time preference and make the argument that there are no exceptions. By the way, this is just an application of the general principle that there are no exceptions to the principle of preference, the general principle of preference. There are no exceptions. There are no exceptions to the more narrow principle of time preference. Let me give you an example of what I mean by an alleged exception to preference. I often use this example with my students in principles classes at Grove City College. So I say, suppose we have a guy who's he's dragging on a cigarette. It's Joe Camel, right? He's dragging on a cigarette. And, he's making casual conversation with you, drags on the cigarette and blows out the smoke. And he says, man, I wish I could kick this nasty habit. This is just, I just hate this. And then after he says that, he drags on the cigarette again. Well, we know the Austrian analysis of this, right? The Austrian analysis is his preferences are consistent with his action. He, no matter what he says, and no matter what he really thinks psychologically about this, he prefers to smoke. That's simply how we use the term preference in economic theorizing. Because if we didn't use the term preference this way, we wouldn't be able to apply it to the explanation of his action. We could, right? we couldn't explain his action by his words, because he says, no, I hate to smoke, and it's an awful nasty habit, and I wish I could kick it. But he's still doing it. So how do we explain the fact that he's doing it? Well, we explain the fact that he's doing it because he prefers it for whatever reason. Right? Regardless of the negative aspects that he attaches to it, there's something, some benefit that he gets from it, and he does it for this reason. So that's what I'm speaking about when I talk about an alleged exception. Okay, so let's think about possible alleged exceptions to time preference. Mises deals with some of these in Human Action, so I'll just kind of run down his list. One example he gives is, okay, you've got this guy, and he is offered two theater tickets for the same night. So two movie tickets, let's say, but they're both for Friday night. And then he says, oh, boy, I wish that, you know, I wish the ticket for Dark Knight Rises was for Saturday night and Friday. I wish it were a future good. I prefer to have it in the future and not in the present. And Mises says, well, this isn't time preference at all, right? This is just the scarcity, the general principle of scarcity of goods. You have to allocate your scarce goods. You can't do everything, right? You have to choose to set aside certain things in order to do something else. And so you have to choose between the two theater shows on Friday. This has nothing to do with time preference. Then he deals with the case of ice in summer and ice in winter. What about this? Isn't this an exception? Wouldn't a person maybe say in the wintertime that he prefers ice in the summer? No, sure, a person could say this, right? But how do we analyze this claim that a person might make? So it's February in Grove City, and it was 20 below zero, and there's snow all over the place, right? And the guy says, I prefer to have ice cubes for my iced tea or whatever in the summer. Well, the most direct way to understand this would be, as we talked about before, that a person values means to a given action differently depending upon when the action is to be taken. So if this guy is planning to use the ice cubes and to cool his iced tea and sit out on his veranda or whatever and enjoy the iced tea, well, this is just a more enjoyable endeavor in the summertime when it's 90 degrees as opposed to the winter when it's 20 below, right? So it may just be that, right? Not time preference. It's just that the timing of his action is such that he can think of more valuable things to do in the summertime with ice than he can in the wintertime with ice. Or it may just be the stock of the good. We talked about diminishing marginal utility on Monday. It might be that he just has a huge amount of ice in the winter. And so a unit of it, he doesn't value very heavily. But in the summertime, he's used a lot of his ice in spring or whatever. Now he doesn't have very much. And so he places greater value on a unit of it. So there are all sorts of explanations for why someone would say this that don't contradict time preference. And then Mises deals with one last case, which is the miser. What about the miser? Doesn't the miser just hoard up everything, and he delays his consumption until the future as much as possible, right? He's just eating gruel every meal, and porridge or whatever, and a little bit of water. And Mises says, well, but his consumption doesn't go to zero, right? Sure, the miser has low time preference, but it's not like he has negative time preference. Like, he delays all of his actions into the future because he thinks that a given satisfaction, eating the porridge, the satisfaction you get from that, is greater tomorrow than it is today. He thinks that perpetually. No, he actually acts in the present. And when he acts in the present, then his time preference is demonstrated. Okay, now let's turn to the rate of interest. So following along the lines of our logical development here, we want to show how to deduce what Mises and what Rothbard likes to call the pure rate of interest, or what Mises called the originary rate of interest, the time preference rate of interest, from time preference. And our schematic would look like this. We'll start with the bottom row here. So this is is kind of a schematic of the explanation of the rate of interest, and then the rest of this is just to integrate it with what we talked about before. So let's start with this second row. So So we say that people have time preferences. They place a particular preference on a given satisfaction in the present as opposed to a same satisfaction in the future. And that their intensity of time preference can differ. So this is just the analog of what we said about the preferences generally for any good. We have some people who have a certain preference for apples relative to money, and then we have other people who have reverse preferences. So they too like apples, but they like to have money more than apples, so their preferences are reverse, and so they engage in trade, and a price emerges, the market clears, as we talked about on Monday. So it's a similar argument here. We have time preferences. We have certain intensity of desire for present satisfactions as opposed to future satisfactions. Just as a matter of terminology, we say that if people have low time preference, we mean that the preference they have for a present satisfaction is slight relative to the future. And if people have high time preference, well, those are the people who really heavily desire a present satisfaction relative to the same satisfaction in the future. And so the low time preference people can become suppliers, in this case of present money. We'll talk more about why the interest rate emerges as a trade of present money in a minute. But you can just think of a loan contract. In the meantime, before we go through the analytics, you can just think of someone, in other words, lending another person money in exchange, in present money, money in the present in exchange for principal plus interest in the future. So we have a person with low time preference willing to supply present money and maybe accept a premium of, say, $100 interest to be paid back in a year on a $1,000 principal. And we have another person with much higher time preference, very eager for the present money. He's got a very urgent end to fulfill in the present, and maybe he's willing to pay a premium of $200. He's willing to pay back $1,200 a year from today to get the $1,000 today. So they can make a mutually advantageous trade at any interest rate between 10% and 20%. They can make a trade. And then you'll have different people in the market. You have a whole bunch of people with these different intensities of preference, some with lower time preference, some with higher. They all come together, and we get a market clearing pure rate of interest. So we won't repeat that kind of argument that we made on Monday, right? We standard kind of argument about how the market would clear. And we'll use this little R to symbolize the pure rate of interest, the time preference rate of interest, the premium, the monetary premium that's placed on the present, on present money, that's based solely upon time preference. Okay, so that's our argument. Notice then that any factor that affects the pure rate of interest can only do so by changing people's time preferences. Just like any factor that affects the price of apples can only do so by altering our preferences, by changing our rank orders of apples against money. It would have to do that, otherwise it wouldn't affect demand and supply, and then it wouldn't affect the price. So the same thing here. All conditions of the world act through our mental judgments of the importance of those changing conditions as we engage in action. So it's the same argument here. Okay, now in the next step then, well, let me mention this thing about the present money first, and then we'll take the next step. We notice, we arrange the logic this way because we notice something about the real world with respect to interest rates, and that this is that interest rates are always denominated in money. It's always the exchange of present money for future money, not apples or men's dress shoes or right or goods. And it's up to us analytically, of course, to figure out the reason why this is the case. Why don't we have intertemporal exchange of goods? We have temporal exchange for goods that we talked about before. People can form forward contracts to trade oil in 6 months or whatever. But we don't have intertemporal trade of these goods. And the reason for this is because, the reason why there's a difference between these two is because with, as we spoke about before, with goods, their temporal value can differ depending upon the moment in time people intend to use them. But with money, this is not the case. And the reason for this is that money is neither a consumer good nor a producer good. Money is simply the medium of exchange. And the value of a unit of money as a medium of exchange is a social phenomena that depends only upon the existence of this thing used in society as a medium of exchange. And so it has no, it doesn't matter, in other words, how I use money in different periods of time. Its value as a medium of exchange is intact. I don't use it for anything else, right? Only for the medium of exchange. And so as I use it today or next month or a year from today and so on and so forth, we can be assured that there is no temporal timing value of the use of it as a medium of exchange. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't some complicating factors in intertemporally trading money. We'll get to those in a minute. But we have a difference here between money and other goods, consumer goods and producer goods. So we can isolate the time preference element in the exchange of present money for future money, whereas we cannot isolate the time preference element in the exchange of present goods for future goods. This is a kind of a critical point. Granted, it's a somewhat advanced, right? It's kind of an arcane point, but it's an important one to see. Okay, now we can integrate our time preference argument about interest with the previous arguments that have been made this week about how preferences determine prices generally. And so to go to the top line, remember we started this discussion on Monday and we said people have preferences for different goods, for different consumer goods, and so they demand and supply them. We use the example of the Honda Civic, or use the example of water, whatever it is. And so the prices of the consumer goods then emerge, and these prices of consumer goods then are imputed by the entrepreneurs to the factors of production that produce them. The entrepreneurs will pay the factors of production their marginal revenue product, the contribution that the factor's productivity makes to the revenue of producing this good. So an auto worker gets the in his wage the value of the revenue that his contribution to production process makes to producing the cars that he's producing. And then we get rental prices for the factors. Now notice rental prices for the factors have two causal elements: the marginal revenue product of the factor and the rate of interest. This is because entrepreneurs, or this will be the case when entrepreneurs pay workers in advance of selling the output that the workers have produced. So if we have a worker and he's producing, let's say, $500 a day worth of output, his contribution to productivity. But let's say it takes 6 months for the good to be produced and sold that he's beginning to produce today. So if the entrepreneur pays him up front, if he pays him his wages, today for that 6 month period, he's not going to pay him the full value of what he's producing as the consumer good will be sold in 6 months, because he's making him a loan of that money today, right? He's paying him up front. He's buying the cost of production. He's incurring the cost of production by buying the factors of production today. The entrepreneur is. Then he's producing the good, and in the future, he's selling the good to the consumer for money. So the entrepreneur is actually involved in lending to the workers. And for this, he will earn a rate of interest. For this, the workers, in other words, are willing to accept a discount, a reduction of what the value of their productivity is in terms of the goods that they're producing in production. And this is true, of course, of all the factors of production. Not just labor. It would be true of if an auto manufacturer is buying steel to make cars, it would be true of the price that he pays today for steel. He can make an agreement with the steel company either to pay them today when the steel is shipped, and then he would agree to a particular price, $500 a ton or whatever it is, or he could pay them upon the sale of the car. He could, in 6 months, he could pay the steel company when the entrepreneur himself receives the revenue stream from the sale of the product he produces. If he's going to do that, he'll pay more for the steel. And the difference between what he would pay in the present and what he will pay in the future is the rate of interest. Okay, so that's the argument. That's how we're integrating these. That's how they integrate into a seamless whole. Okay, then we have capital value, and capital value exists for durable goods, consumer goods and producer goods, that generate a stream of monetary value. So if the auto manufacturer has a physical plant, is a factory in which he's producing the automobiles, that factory will generate marginal revenue product year after year for the life of the factory. And the question is, how much present money today would an entrepreneur be willing to pay to buy the factory? And the answer is, an entrepreneur would be willing to buy the factory at a price that was equal to the sum of this stream of marginal revenue product into the future, discounted to make it equivalent to present money by the rate of interest. So that's where capital value comes from. Perhaps now you can see how the interest rate is related to claims on capital value, like stocks and bonds. So we have a bond, and it's just a claim on the capital value of an asset. We have stock. It's a claim on the equity, the difference between the assets and the liabilities of an entrepreneur's enterprise. And it will obviously, these claims will, their value will depend upon the rate of interest. It will go up and down depending upon the rate of interest. So once again, this is crucial for business cycle theory. If the central bank pushes interest rates artificially low, they'll also artificially boost capital values in the economy, all throughout the economy. Right? Stock markets will boom, land prices will rise, and so on. And this sets in motion the kind of misallocations that occur in the buildup of the capital structure during the boom. Okay, now let's just make a few additional statements about this, just again, kind of clarifying remarks now that we've sketched out this theory. One of them is to see, as Murray Rothbard puts it, that the rate of interest, this pure rate of interest, and we're not dealing with any complications yet, just this idea that people have time preference and they express it in their exchange of present money for future money, is ubiquitous. It exists in every exchange of present money for future money. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are surrounding this exchange. So we've mentioned a couple of these two major circumstances already. One would be credit markets. So in credit markets, we have a contract that's formed between the lender and the borrower. So we have like the mortgage market, right? And so we have a homeowner who wants to borrow some money, and we have a saver who's lending the money. And they form a contract that agrees upon the payback schedule and what the rate of interest is and, you know, what the present money being lent, what the sum is, and so on and so forth. All right, so that's part of what Rothbard calls the time market. That's part of the overall market of trading present money for future money. But the biggest part of this market in an advanced capitalist economy is the entire capital structure. Because in the whole capital structure, we have entrepreneurs advancing money to the owners of the factors of production, paying their costs in advance, then producing the good, and then after the good is produced, offering it to the consumer, selling the good, receiving the revenues that compensate for those costs that they paid in the past. And as we just went through the argument, the entrepreneur, the capitalist entrepreneur, must earn a rate of interest for this investment. I think someone made this comment on one of the lectures on Monday, that the bulk of gross saving that occurs in an advanced capitalist economy is done by entrepreneurs through their enterprises. It's not personal saving on our part. It's that these entrepreneurs are taking their revenues and plowing them back into the purchase of the factors of production. And for this investment, they're earning a rate of interest. This is part of the overall market for supply and demand of present money that determines the rate of interest. To put this somewhat differently then, credit markets, like the credit card market and the mortgage market, where we have a credit transaction and an explicit loan contract, the interest rate on those markets conforms to the general rate of interest in the overall time market. Those markets do not set rates of interest, but conform to the existing overall conditions of demand and supply of present money and time markets. It's also the case, just one other nuance here, that time preference, the market for capital funding does not determine by itself the rate of interest. It too conforms to the overall rates, right? Our argument, again, is that time preference determines both the amount that people save and invest and the rate of interest simultaneously. Just like our general argument is that preferences for apples or men's dress shoes, determine both the quantity of apples traded and the price. They determine both demand and supply, as well as the price. And so we shouldn't think of these two things, saving and investing, as disparate, right? They're not disparate, determined by other factors. They're actually integrated by time preference into one seamless set of actions. Okay, now let's go to the complications. So we've got the basic rate of interest, the basic time preference rate of interest. The basic reason there is a rate of interest in the economy is time preference. But time preference isn't the only factor that can affect the exchange of present money for future money, and therefore the premium that present money commands over future money, the rate of interest. So let's run through some of this argument, and we'll begin with this breakdown of an entrepreneur's gross profit, and then we'll get to the components of the what we'll call the market rate of interest. So the gross profit of an entrepreneurial enterprise, or what accountants would call net income, the difference between their revenue from selling their output and their costs from buying their inputs, we can break into four sources. There are four productive contributions that the capitalist entrepreneur makes for which he earns income in his enterprise. One of these, the one we talked about already, is he earns interest income by investing his capital funding into the production process. Now, of course, many entrepreneurs also borrow capital from capitalists, in which case they don't earn, right? They don't earn that interest. They pay it out of their revenues. But a lot of financing of investment is self-financing by the entrepreneurs. To the extent that they do this, their gross profit or net income will have as one part of it an interest return. They earn profit for their superior foresight. So if we have an entrepreneur, we have Tim Cook, and he better anticipates that the new iPhone 5 needs a bigger screen. He better anticipates satisfying our preferences for these devices relative to other entrepreneurs. Then when he brings this good to market, he will earn profit for his superior foresight, right? For the fact that he has brought to market at the right time, in the right quantity, at the right price, the goods that we prefer relative to other goods that other entrepreneurs have brought forth for us. The entrepreneur can also earn wages for supplying labor in his production process. So many entrepreneurs supply labor services, which they could hire out to someone else. And that, too, would, if they provide their own labor services, that would show up. That income would show up in their net income, since they don't have a cost associated with it. They wouldn't be expending any cost associated with that labor service. It would show up in net income. And then a fourth category is what Mises would call quasi-wages. Quasi-wages accrue to entrepreneurs for their leadership skills. And what Mises has in mind here is that an entrepreneur might, by his organizational abilities or his inspirational abilities, might actually increase the productivity of people who work for him. He might just create the environment in which they work more productively together. And for this, he can earn quasi-wages because he can sell this skill to other entrepreneurs who can't accomplish this. So this happens quite frequently in the market. You get a company and it's a merger takeover or something, and it's run into the ground by the management. They don't know what they're doing, right? And then some sharper entrepreneur will raise some capital, buy up the assets of the company at bargain basement prices because the previous entrepreneurial group has you know destroyed the company, and then they'll provide these leadership abilities. They'll put a new group of management together, and they'll reorganize their human resource arrangements, and they'll organize divisions differently, and so on. So this is this can, in fact, be part also of net income. We say this just because we want to be able to make the point that when we actually look in the real world and we see the disparate gross incomes that are being earned, I mean net incomes or gross profits that are being earned by the different entrepreneurs, we want to make sure that we're not confusing two different things, right? Which is, on the one hand, we know that the rate of interest across all different production processes of similar duration will, and similar riskiness and so on, will be the same. Because if it isn't the same, if you can earn a 10% return in one area and a 5% in another, then the capitalists will shift their investments toward the high return area, and they'll bring these two rates of return into equality. But the gross income of different entrepreneurial ventures isn't just interest, right? And so we don't actually see the uniformity of net income per unit of investment across different firms, even though we know theoretically that the rate of return, the interest rate of return, is in fact uniform. Okay, now let's go to this difference between the different components of the market rate of interest. So again, we've dealt only with one of these, so this is a complicating factor again, and this is the pure rate of interest. So once again, our argument would be that the pure rate of interest is the basis of the market rate of interest. There's a time preference premium of present money that's the same across all the different areas of lending and borrowing in the economy of similar sort, a similar duration and riskiness and so on. Okay, then there's another component to any particular market rate of interest that Mises calls the entrepreneurial uncertainty component. So there's different riskiness involved in different entrepreneurial ventures. And in order for capitalists to have incentive to invest in them, the riskier projects, they'll require higher rates of return. So we'll see higher rates of interest in riskier endeavors, lower rates of interest, that is rates of return, in less risky endeavors. So that's what explains this market phenomenon of diversity, when our theory would argue that the pure rate of interest is the same everywhere. That's not what we see, right? We see different rates of interest. How do we explain this? Well, one part of the explanation is that different projects have different riskiness associated with them, and therefore they command different rates of return. The price premium refers to what happens with the Cantillon effects when the money supply is increased or decreased, when the money relation changes. In different industries, there could be differential effects. The new money might hit one industry first before it hits other industries, and it might drive prices up for the output produced in those industries and create a greater rate of return there than in other areas where the new money only hits these markets later. So again, we could get disparity in rates of return in different endeavors in the market because of this price premium. And then finally, there are unanticipated changes in the PPM, the inflation premium, that might also make its way into the rate of interest. Rothbard here, I think, has a definitive argument. He says, let's suppose we have a situation where the money relation has changed, let's say the money supply increases, and that the entrepreneurs in the market anticipate that because of the increase in the supply of money, prices in the future will be higher. Well, then what will they do? And he says, what they'll do, of course, is they'll bid more heavily for the factors of production today, because they know that if they can get those factors of production today at existing prices, they can produce goods and get a 10% premium, you know, 10% higher prices than they would have otherwise in the future. So this will cause the factors of production prices to rise today, and therefore the spread between prices of the factors of production and prices of output will not change. The interest rate will not change as long as the effect on inflation is anticipated. But if the effect is unanticipated, then the rates of return will be disparate, right? If the entrepreneurs don't see that the prices of things will be 10% higher in the future, they'll pay for the factors of production today just like normal, and the prices of the factors of production will just be what they would have been otherwise. But then when they sell their good in the future, they'll get 10% higher prices. It is true that those won't be commanding real purchasing power, but they will show up in net income, right? It will show up as the appearance of a larger net income. Okay, now the last thing we want to do in this discussion is talk about the critics. So I've sort of sketched out this theory, some of the implications, some of the nuances of it, and so on. And now let's deal with the critics. And I think the best way to organize this material is to pose what Bumbavor called the interest problem and see how different authors suggest solving the interest problem. Okay, so Bumbavor says the interest problem is this. The price of a capital good today, a capital good that's going to generate marginal revenue product in the future, the price of that capital good today is not bid up to incorporate the full value of its future stream of marginal revenue product. So if you add up the full value of all the marginal revenue product, you know, all the revenue to be earned by using this factory in the future, it might come to $10 million. But no entrepreneur will pay $10 million to buy the factory today. But this is just a fact, Bumbavor is saying, of capitalism. And so he says, how do we explain this fact? And he says, we explain this by time preference, by the fact that no entrepreneur, capitalist entrepreneur, is crazy enough to pay $10 million today just to get $10 million back over the next 20 years. Well, he's going to pay something less than that today. Why? Because of time preference, because he discounts the future relative to the present. Okay, so that's the time preference answer to this interest problem. Okay, now let's take the exploitation theory of interest. So this is one alternative view that would criticize the time preference view. This is the Marxist view of interest. And it says that interest is the surplus value of labor that's extracted by the capitalist. Right? So Marx claimed that through the labor theory of value, that the full monetary value of a product is due to the application of labor. So every hour of labor is worth $10, and you use 10 hours of labor to produce a product, and the price of the product will be $100. And then the entrepreneur earns interest only by then taking that value, taking what belongs to the worker away from him. If the capitalist pays $90 to the worker, he's simply exploited the worker and taken the value of what he's produced, part of the value of what he's produced. So we won't talk about the fallacies of the labor theory of value, but simply point out that in our view, the response to this would be that labor is in fact paid its full value. Consider the scenario where the capitalist entrepreneur, instead of paying the worker in advance, he just paid his worker, this $10 an hour worker, he just paid this worker for producing $100 worth of output. He just paid him when the output was sold. Well, then he would pay him the full $100. The only reason he pays him $90 today is because of the discount of present money, because he's advancing money to this worker. And so this is the rebuttal to this claim about exploitation theory. Or as I said at the bottom line here, the worker could just take his advance payment of, say, $90 and put it out on interest. And at the end of the period when the good is actually sold, he would have the full value again, right? So how is the capitalist entrepreneur exploiting him? He's benefiting him by extending him a loan. Okay, then there are productivity theories of interest. These are quite common. And these basically claim that capital, the use of capital, generates a flow of productive services. And it is this flow of productive services that we call interest. And there are a huge number of examples of this, and we won't go into all the literature, but I'm using this example, this common example about rice. So we have 100 units of rice, and in a year it matures into 110 units of rice. And there are other authors who use sheep and Crusonian plants and all sorts of strange contrivances to get this point across. So the idea is that there's a real rate of return of 10%. That's the argument. So why does the value of capital, why is the value of capital in excess of its present value? It's because it generates a real rate of return. And if you own it, you get that rate of return. You get that extra 10 units of rice every year. Okay, so what's wrong with this? Well, our view would be, of course, that this physical productivity does not affect the rate of interest at all. This physical productivity would be built into the marginal revenue product, that is, what's being paid to buy this stock of rice or this machine that's generating these values. Or a better analogy here would be land, right? Land sort of perpetually generates a physical surplus. But if we were to imagine doubling the physical surplus that's generated by land, let's say the wheat output per acre is doubled, this just means that the land's price would double. It says nothing about the difference in value between the present value of what someone would pay for the land and the stream of value that the land generates over its lifetime. That would still be determined by rates of return. Or as I put the case here, if we have an asset that generates a perpetual marginal revenue product, then its capital value would just be its marginal revenue product divided by the interest rate. So it would be like a British perpetuity. Like they had bonds that went on forever, presumably. Never paid the principal, but always paid the interest. And so in our example, let's say we had, again, we had a $10 value for the 10 units of rice that would to be generated every year. Now, if the rate of return and if people's time preference rate were 10%, that just means that the stock of rice would sell for $100. You'd be willing to pay, in other words, $100 to buy the stock of rice that generates $10 in marginal revenue product every year. That would give you your time preference rate of 10%. But if people's time preferences fell to 5%, how would this change things? Would the rate of return still be 10%? No. What would happen is now to get a 10% return every year, people would be willing to pay $200 for the stock of rice. They'd be willing to bid more heavily for the stock of rice, and their bidding up of the capital value of the rice or the land, whatever this is, it's becoming more productive, would make the rate of return conform to their time preferences. We could also point out that, and I won't take a long time to elaborate on this, that the interest return will exist regardless of the productivity, regardless of whether there's any productivity in the economy. We can see this, by the way, in consumer loans. There is no productivity that generates the interest value to be paid back in a consumer loan, right? It's just the consumer just uses it to buy a car or whatever. Where does he get the money to pay back the interest? And the answer is he gets it out of his stock of goods. He's accumulated a stock of goods or will in the future accumulate a stock of goods, and he pays the interest out of that. So this can happen in any circumstance, even if we don't have production. Okay, now there are eclectic theories. This is the neoclassical theory of interest. And it's like the Marshallian scissors, generally, right? We have subjective value and demand on one side of the market, and we have objective production cost on the other side, and they jointly determine the price of a good. So we have a similar thing here. We have time preferences that determine a supply of loanable funds, and we have the productivity of capital that determines demand for loanable funds, and then they, in combination, they determine the rate of interest. Now, as we said Monday in the lecture, the more general principle, this also violates the more general principle that causal explanations must proceed from ends to means. And so there isn't any way to have an independent value contribution of the productivity of capital. If, on the other hand, you say, like the neoclassical school does, if you say, well, the productivity of capital is determined in turn by the by its marginal revenue product, by the value of what it's producing elsewhere, well, then you're involved in the fallacy of the vicious circle, right? If I have factors of production and I say that my capital goods price is determined by the rate of interest, and then I say because of that price, that determines the rate of interest, I'm engaged in the fallacy of circular reasoning. This is Boom-Bobrick's theory. So notice Boom-Bobrick says that Boom-Bobrick is not a pure time preference theorist. He says that time preference is defined as the premium of present goods over future goods, and that premium that we place upon present goods is fundamentally determined by the value productivity of capital and various subjective factors. And once again, the basic problem here is that he has not begun with our ends-means framework. He hasn't started with the end that we're trying to attain through the action that we're taking. He's jumping in the middle and saying, it would be like jumping in at the start with demand and supply analysis and just saying, let's propose demand and supply, and then we get the price. And then later on, we'll talk about the subjective factors that affect our demand and supply. No, that's not the way we do it in the Austrian view. We start with our mental judgments of the ends that we're pursuing, and this leads us to the action of demanding and supplying and the premium that is the price that's set on goods. So the same sort of criticism could be brought to bear on Boom-Bobrick. Well, I see that even though I haven't made it to the end, I've exhausted the time. So we'll quit there, and I'd be happy to take questions individually if any of you have some. So, thank you. Thanks.